Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is author Francine Prose. She's joined in conversation by Holly Furfer. And now join Holly Furfer as she introduces Francine Prose.
So on behalf of the Marcus JCC here in Atlanta and the National JCC Literary Consortium, I am so pleased to welcome you. And tonight we have a very special guest. This is a New York Times best-selling author, Francine Prose. We're going to talk about her new novel, The Vixen, which the Washington Post described as, quote, a very funny, serious story or a very serious, funny story. And we'll get to the bottom of that with Ms. Prose. Francine Prose is the author of 21 works of fiction, including the highly acclaimed Mr. Monkey and Blue Angel, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. And her works of nonfiction include the highly praised Anne Frank, The Book, The Life, The Afterlife, and the New York Times bestseller, Reading Like a Writer, which has really become a classic. The recipient of numerous grants and honors, including a Guggenheim and a Fulbright, Ms. Prose is a former president of Pan American Center, and she is a distinguished writer in residence at Bard College. So I'd like to welcome Ms. Francine Prose. And here she comes. There we go, Hi. Technology. Hi, Francine.
Thank you so much.
So great to have you here. I have a million questions for you. But first, for those who don't have the book yet or haven't had a chance to read The Vixen, just what is this book about?
Well, it takes place in 1953, 1954, and it begins on the night of the execution of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg as spies. And my hero is a young man named Simon Putnam, who's just graduated from Harvard and can't really see his future ahead of him. And he's stuck home with his parents, and they're watching the report from the execution on TV. His mother was a close or a neighbor of Ethel Rosenberg. So the execution has a special meaning for the family. So then fast forward a few months and he gets a job at a very tony white shoe New York publisher as a reader of the slush pile. And his first real assignment is this sleazy, lurid bodice ripper based on the Rosenberg case, which this tony publisher is supposedly publishing because it might make money and put the finances back in the black. So that's really how the novel begins, and it just spins out from there.
When you say spins out, you don't mean that lightly. It spins out, and there is a huge plot twist in the middle. We'll get to it, and we'll warn everybody if you haven't read it yet. But talk a little bit about the idea of how you came up with doing this, centering this around the Rosenberg trial. And there's a special connection that you actually really have in real life.
Yeah, I mean, like my hero, my mother knew Ethel Rosenberg as a child. They grew up on the Lower East Side together. And my mother, until the very end of her life, she lived to be quite old, had three friends with whom she'd grown up. And they all knew Ethel. So they would talk about her. I mean, they were all, what should I say? I mean, all of them were very kind of competitive, driven, first-generation immigrant girls. So they were a little jealous of Ethel because she sang opera and she kind of had a future ahead of her, as it turned out, not. So they admired her for what she'd been in high school and were deeply affected by the execution. On the other hand, their politics couldn't have been more different from Ethel's. I mean, Ethel really was a communist, and I think that my mother and her friends were so eager to become part of the American dream and the American success story that it was mystifying to them that someone could be, in their view, anti-American, because that was really the polar opposite of how they saw politics in the country and the world.
And so growing up and hearing this from your mom and your mom's friends, was that something you always had an interest in? Was that something in your back of your mind as a writer for so many years, thinking someday I'm going to delve into that?
Yeah. And this particular book, I mean, The Vixen, I started it. I started numbering my drafts after a while because so I had 14 drafts of the first three chapters, and it didn't work, and it didn't work, and it didn't work. And then finally, I realized how I could do the first chapter, which is the families watching TV and interspersed with the reports from Sing Sing, where the execution was held, are TV sitcom, 50 TV sitcoms like I Love Lucy and the Ozzie and Harriet Nelson show. So once I realized I could do that and that it would get it at the tone I wanted it in the novel and this kind of weird mix of comedy and seriousness that I wanted. And also because those 50 sitcoms were very much about the family and some kind of strange 50s idea of family, which the novel is also very much about. And in a way, the Rosenberg case as well was about.
Yeah, and it's genius. In the beginning, you have two Ethels, Ethel Mertz from I Love Lucy and Ethel Rosenberg, who's in Sing Sing about to be executed. And that's how the whole novel goes. Everything is interspersed. And some of the most brilliant, in my opinion, writing is your terrible writing. Talk about how you did that, because you did it on purpose, because this novel is supposed to be horrific.
Yeah, it was total fun. I mean, I've said this before, but writing badly on purpose is just about the most fun you can have as a writer. I mean, not so much fun when you're doing it accidentally and you can't help it. But when you sit down that day and say, I'm going to just write as terribly as I possibly can today, it's just bliss.
And a little cathartic, I bet, you know, sort of a little revenge.
all the things you've been denying yourself all this time just come pouring up.
I love that. Okay, talk about the main character, Simon Putnam. He's so complicated, but on a simple level.
He's young. I mean, that's the thing that I kept remembering and kept trying to imagine my way back to. But, you know, I teach as well. So I'm around, and I have kids and grandkids and stuff. So I'm around young people. And I'm immensely sympathetic, especially for that time in your life when you have just graduated from college and your life is supposed to be starting and you have no idea what that life is going to be. I mean, you just can't. Something's been promised to you, or you've aimed for something and it just hasn't happened. And you're only in your 20s and you're at the start of something, but you don't know what that something is. I mean, I can remember myself walking around the streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts with tears just sheeting down my face because it seemed to me I didn't have a life. And so it was very easy for me to write my way back into the horror of being back in your parents' apartment after you think you're going to be someplace else.
And you walk us through Simon and his landing his first big job. Talk about the job that he got and how he got it and what he had to do.
Well, as I said, he's working for this old school publisher which is very much like the publisher that published my first novel in 1973, I think 74. And it really was a kind of old white boys club that is on its way out. I mean, it's not as if it doesn't exist anymore, but it certainly. And I remember very clearly, in fact, the office, the publisher's office in the novel is based identically on the office of Athenaeum, which I used to go to. And the very first time that I went there, they took me to meet the head of the publishing company, who said to me, "You didn't write this whole book all by yourself, did you?" Horrifying. I mean, it's something that you would know better than to say to a young woman now, but at that point, you know, anything went. You could just say anything you want. So as I said, he's given this job to edit this just terrible, terrible book. And it kind of spins out. He's gotten the job through his connections, his uncle, who's a kind of public intellectual. The most purely autobiographical scene in the book, his uncle takes him out to lunch at a restaurant in New York where a lot of publishing people go. And this is what happened to me. I had graduated from college and I didn't drink much in college. I mean, it just wasn't something I did. And this was back in the day of the 2-3 martini lunch. So my editor said to me, "Well, have a drink." And I didn't know what any drinks were. So I ordered a whiskey sour. It was the only drink that I knew. And I could still remember the look of horror he gave my class. as it came. So so I drank my whiskey sour, and then we split half a bottle of white wine. And then the waiter moved the table away so I could, so we could get up at the end of the meal, and I just fell over. And that's what happens. And I mean, my editor gallantly walked me to a taxi cab. So
and that's so, in that the book.
Real. That's in the book.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because you do talk about that sort of, it seems very Mad Men, where it's, you know, these men and it's all about what they, you know, their power and their, so a little bit, so it sort of gives us an insight into the publishing world. And really it was like that from top to bottom, because they talk about the publicist Elaine, and I'd love you to talk about her character as well. She was sort of the sweet, maybe not so sweet that we find out, but is that how it kind of worked in the publishing world?
Yeah. And it was, and it, as it, it was still in the day where the head of the publishing company could just sleep with all the women in the publishing company, or the, you know, all the women. And that was okay. I mean, it was so before Me Too. And it, as you said, it was very, very much Mad Men. So, so Elaine is sort of the Peggy and the,
yep,
all those characters put, the women characters put together.
And then, so Simon lands this amazing dream job, and talk about this. Is it Sludge? Did you say, is that what it's called, that he has to go through everything? I mean, is that how it works?
Yeah, I think that's how it worked then. I mean, I'm not sure how that works now, but that is, you know, there were and probably still are two ways of submitting to a publisher. That is, your agent submits and has lunch with somebody or whatever, blah, blah. And then people just mail their manuscripts in. So he has to deal with this kind of Herculean stack of endlessly growing manuscripts that he's supposed to read and write some sort of commentary on. I mean, that was another fun part, was just making up the names of all these horrible books that he had to read.
They were, I mean, it's so funny. I did find myself chuckling all the way through, thinking, could this be real? How real is this? It was great genius. And so now he gets The Vixen, and the head of the publishing house puts it on his desk for a reason. Talk about his conflict of The Vixen and what The Vixen really was.
Well, he because of his family and because of his own conscience. I mean, I always thought about the book as a novel about how you develop a conscience, or how somebody develops a conscience. So he's really torn, because on the one hand, he wants to get ahead in publishing. He wants this career. He wants to please his charismatic boss. He wants all these rewards that he imagines coming to him if he does what he is supposed to do, which is to make this terrible book slightly less terrible. On the other hand, he knows it's a terrible book. It's full of lies about the Rosenbergs, who are very thinly disguised, called the Rosensteins in the novel. And the novel makes poor Ethel Rosenberg out to be this kind of sex-crazed nympho Matahari. And he knows it's a huge betrayal of everything he believes in, of everything his family believes in, of his mother's feelings about the Rosenbergs. And so he's caught all the way through between what he knows is right and wrong, and what he knows is going to advance him professionally.
It's almost like he's caught between guilt and innocence. Mm-hmm. Like this sort of, it's his dilemma. And then talk about the author, Anya, and her character, because she was, to me, the most intriguing character of all. And I love how you ended her. We're not going to tell you how you ended her, but I love what happens to her. Tell us about Anya.
Well, she's, we never exactly find out how she got where she got to. I mean, that's one of the unresolved mysteries. She's living in either an incredibly beautiful mental asylum on the banks of the Hudson, or the simulacrum of incredibly beautiful mental asylum on the banks of the Hudson. And she has written The Vixen. In fact, the novel within the novel is called The Vixen, The Patriot, and The Fanatic. So she's the putative author of the novel. And she herself is the little vixen, seductive, a little crazy, wild. And Simon, of course, who is at an age where he's falling in love with every woman he meets, falls in love with her. So she's one of the several women he falls in love with in the course of the novel.
Now, I want to give everyone a warning, because the book takes a bit of a twist, and I do want to talk about it. So if you don't want any spoilers, turn the volume down. You can come back on. You may not know what we're talking about, but I don't want to ruin it for everybody. But turn your volume off if you don't want to hear this. So in the book, we find out who actually wrote the book and why. So tell us about that.
Well, the kind of sub theme that becomes the real theme of the book is that it's about the this, of course, is real, the so-called cultural Cold War that the CIA was waging all through the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, that is using soft power as a way of promoting American democracy. So they funded publications like the Paris Review and Encounter. They sent groups of jazz bands to Europe. They sent they were instrumental in promoting Jackson Pollock, because they were saying, well, here in America, you can just drip onto the canvas, whereas in the horrible Soviet Union, you have to paint these awful Soviet realist paintings. So The Vixen, The Patriot, and The Fanatic, the novel within the novel, turns out to be part of the of this Cold War effort to deal with the international response to the Rosenberg case, and to kind of, as if that were possible through this novel, persuade people that the Rosenbergs actually were, or even worse than they were said to be.
So I mean, I remember I was reading this, and it made me question everything that I've read and everything from around that time, because it's the height of McCarthyism. You talk about Roy Cohn, who was one of his henchmen, where everybody was questioning everybody else and everybody was calling on everyone else, and it was sort of this really tense time. So how does that sort of play in with how this whole novel, how his whole discovery unravels?
Well, it was a time, I mean, one of the reasons that I think it was possible to write about now, and one of the reasons that it was so scary to write about now, was that I kept discovering more and more connections between the 50s and the present moment. I mean, there were these deep cultural divisions and these deep political divisions and a great deal of distrust on both sides, and a lot of fake news and a lot of rumors. And McCarthy, I mean, McCarthy was basically ruined people's lives just on the basis of his say-so. There was no trial, there was no judge, there was no jury. Once you appeared before the McCarthy Committee, and you were accused of being a communist, whether regardless of what you had done or what you hadn't done, you lost your job, your family was in trouble, your life was basically over.
Talk a little bit also about, you know, as you mentioned, McCarthy would just point the finger, and all of a sudden, whether you were guilty or not, just the whole question would ruin somebody. And you think about at the time, Albert Einstein, Jean-Paul Sartre, Picasso, all of them actually wrote to the government, wrote to the president and said, look, the Rosenbergs are innocent. This is, you know, you can't be doing this. And nobody listened. How scary was it in that time for someone like your mom, who might have known them, who could have gotten wrapped into this if they had done some deep diving? And how much of that sort of spilled over when you were talking about, you know, the fears in the novel as he's figuring this out and thinking, how is he wrapped into it? Because he was afraid there was going to be a knock on his door any moment, because people were going to say, you must be a part of this because you're rewriting this novel.
Well, I think that there had to be some connection. I mean, one of the things about the McCarthy hearings was that people were forced basically to name names of people they were associated with politically. So if you lived in the same neighborhood as somebody, there was not such a great chance that your name was going to be named. On the other hand, if you had ever gone to a political meeting with this person, you were in deep trouble. So that's, you know, as we know, that a huge percentage of Hollywood screenwriters, their lives were ruined, and they couldn't work in Hollywood, so they had to write under pseudonyms from then on. I mean, there's a wonderful Coen Brothers movie called Hail Caesar, I think, about that period, and it's about screenwriters in Hollywood. It's hilarious and beautiful, and it's about partly about the situation they found themselves in.
I mean, it's interesting is that, you know, we look back now and we think about the 1950s, how idealistic it was, and how, the, you know, the country, it was so safe, and it was small town USA, and everything was so wonderful, black and white, all, you know, Ozzie and Harriet and I Love Lucy, everything was all wholesome. But truly, there was a lot of moral ambiguity in the 1950s.
Well, it was great if you were a white man. I think things were pretty good. But if you were a woman or a person of color, things were even worse than they are now.
You're listening to author Francine Prose, whose new novel is The Vixen. She's joined in conversation by Holly Furfer on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kaalw.org.
Your character is sort of the son born in the U.S., but his parents were immigrants. And he was sort of talk about his internal fight of wanting to be all American, but then also came from this very Jewish, family from Coney Island, and how he sort of was fighting that. You gave him the ambiguity of the name Putnam, where it really wasn't a Jewish name. Talk about how you kind of set that up.
Well, this also actually happened. I mean, at various points, there were immigration officials who worked at Ellis Island or the immigration centers in Boston and so forth. And I knew a woman in Boston whose parents had arrived from Russia on St. Patrick's Day. So the immigration official took every Jewish name and put Mick in front of it. So, you know, McRubin, McKrensky, all this. They have so Putnam is given, so Simon's family is given the name Putnam just at the whim of some patriotic immigration official who just names everybody after pilgrims. So that's that, you know, and he feels, as he feels all the way through, that his life is based on a kind of lie, because he's certainly not going to correct people who think he actually is that person. He actually is that old family, a descendant of Puritans and so forth.
And he also tried to a bit cover it up. I mean, with Anya, the writer, he didn't tell her he was from Coney Island, that his parents were there. I mean, he sort of hid his background. And like you said, when people, you know, would, they didn't know, he wouldn't tell people, oh, I'm Jewish. My parents are immigrants. I live in Coney Island. He wanted to hide all that.
Yeah, I think that was very true of that sort of borderline first, second generation, that you did everything. You know, people changed their names, or that certainly my grandmother changed our name from God knows what. So that passionate desire to fit in and assimilate was very strong. And I think one of the things that he begins to realize in the novel, and that I think that generation realized, was the cost of it. I mean, for example, turning your back on these fabulous, lively, big, loud, multi-generational families for the nuclear family of the 50s and moving to the suburbs and so forth. I mean, yeah, you became American, but a great deal was lost in the process.
You have two publishers that of the publishing house. So there's Warren Landry and there's Preston. Talk about Preston. This was sort of an ostracized man. He was sort of marginalized, but he ends up becoming a central character in the end. Tell us a bit about that character.
Well, he's in the mental hospital or whatever it is with Anya. So that's where Simon catches up with him. And he's the one who knows
the truth,
secrets and spoilers, which we're not going to tell all of them, but he's the one who knows. So the last half of the novel is a kind of detective story where Simon is beginning to get these hints of what actually happened, of what is really going on, of what he's really been asked to do. So the various people he talks to and meets in the second half of the novel are all people who reveal bits of information to him that help him solve this mystery of what his real job is and who's behind it.
And what's amazing is, just personally, as we're reading the novel, it's discovery for us too. I didn't see where things were coming. So as I'm reading it, and maybe I'm just, but as I'm reading it, I'm like, oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. Now things started to, there were strings drawn to the beginning, and all of a sudden, oh, that makes a lot of sense. So it's really interesting how you had to weave everything through. But what I loved about one of the characters, and I'm going to call Coney Island a character, because you really made it such an integral part of the novel. Is there a personal connection with Coney Island? And it's really interesting because how you juxtapose, you know, the funhouse mirrors, which distort everything. It just sort of spoke to the whole novel till you figure out what's going on.
I grew up in Brooklyn. I mean, I didn't grow up in Coney Island, but I grew up in well, it was Flatbush then, and now it's been given a real estate name of Ditmas Park. But I grew up near enough. I mean, by the time I was in seventh grade or eighth grade, we would ride our bicycles to Coney Island and of course lie to our parents about where we've been. So I spent a lot of time there. And in fact, Simon has a kind of addiction to the roller coaster, to the cyclone, which he rides over and over. And one of my best friends from all the way from junior high school, who's still my close friend, had that. She and her friends, I mean, I was a big scaredy cat, so I wasn't going to do that, but they would go to Coney Island and just ride the cyclone over and over and over. I mean, it was a way of getting high if you're a pre-drug teenager.
Well, and it's funny because here I am reading so much into it, and I was like, oh, I understand the cyclone. He's sort of on this roller coaster ride in his life between the author Anya and between, you know, what the people in the publishing house. So I saw it as a metaphor to his life. Who knew it was an addiction?
Well,
that was
it's
terrific.
An addiction and a metaphor for his life.
So let me ask you a little bit about the writing process. You know, you talked a little bit about, you know, there was a personal connection to Ethel Rosenberg with your mom, but how long does it take you to, is this like an idea that you've had for a long time and you think, okay, I'm going to write this book. You said there was a lot of iterations of the first part of the book, but how long, what's your process of writing and how long does it take for you to get from beginning to here it is?
Well, of course, it's different for every book. I mean, this book, if you count the 14 terrible early drafts, it's probably 10 years. But once I started, you know, and again, it was the minute I got that first chapter, it was like, bingo, I can do this. And then maybe it was 2 years really after that and revisions after that. But it was fun. It was enormous fun to write. I mean, I was so happy the whole time I was writing it. And the great part is I have a very good editor who made some terrific suggestions. So the real fun part was making these little tiny tweaks and changes that made it better after it was done, because once you have a first draft, the terror has gone away. I mean, it's there. So it's not like you're not going to finish it. It's done. And then you just have the job of making it better, which is just a joy.
Is your process different for writing nonfiction?
In a way, yeah. I mean, there are similarities. I mean, clarity is a obvious, you know, I just try and tell a story and make it as clear as possible. But it's much more fun writing fiction because you don't know where it's going to go. I mean, writing nonfiction, you get a certain amount of information and you just have to tell the story and put it together. And writing fiction, a character will say something and you'll go like, oh my God, I had no idea that was going to happen. And then things just continue from there. It's great.
When you start, do you know where it's going to end or you sort of let it take you where it goes?
You hope like halfway through, you know where it's going to end. You hope. But once you do, then it's just coasting after that.
Man, that sounds very scary. Let me go to a couple questions here while we're chatting. Susan and Warren Smallwood Ernst want to know about Anya being a Russian name. Was that very purposeful?
Yeah, you know, that her character evolved. I mean, originally, when I started writing the book, I had someone much more together in mind than Anya. And in fact, I had someone for political reasons and literary reasons, I had someone kind of like Ayn Rand, who was Russian for Anya's character. And then and Anya is really an anagram for Ayn, you know, A-Y-N, blah, blah, blah. So she morphed into, Ayn Rand morphed, or an Ayn Rand-like character morphed into Anya. So yeah, it is a Russian name. She's not Russian, but it's certainly a Russian name.
She was a really complicated character. There were times when I really liked her and times when I didn't like her at all. Did you like her as a character?
I found her interesting. I mean, I never know, you know, I have great sympathy for most of the, well, that's not true. I have great sympathy for all except one or two of the characters in the
novel. Do you have sympathy for Uncle Maddie? He just seemed like...
Yeah, well, Uncle Maddie's a sadist and a nightmare. Other than that, and of course, Warren, the boss. But Anya, I did. I mean, again, she's young, you know, and I just have, no matter what, I just feel for people in their 20s and 30s. It's not easy.
You teach kids in their 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. How do you sort of direct them when, you know, a lot of them are sort of struggling, and how do you help them in their writing process?
Well, I teach literature. I don't actually teach them to write, but I do teach them to write. I mean, because they have to do a 300-word essay every week in advance of what we're talking about. So,
yeah.
And then the thing is, it's really easy. I mean, you sit down with a student and you go, what did you mean when you wrote this sentence? And they tell you what they meant. And what they say is usually so much clearer than what they've written. And then you just say, why didn't you write that? And then they do write that. And then their next paper is a million times better.
When you're teaching in literature, what do you think are the classics that everybody should read? Or what are some of the books that might not be classics that you think all of us should read, whether you're 20s, 30s, or 50s, or 80s?
Well, you know, at the end of Reading Like a Writer, my publisher said, you need a bibliography. So I went, okay. And then I hired this graduate student to just extract every book I'd mentioned. So I think there are like 118 books at the end. And instead of calling it bibliography, I called it like books to be read immediately or something. So there are 118 there. You can start anywhere. And, I, you know, were I to write it again now, I would certainly add to it. So let's say 200.
Is there, what's your one to go to book, the book that you've read over and over and over again? I mean, when you mention Ayn Rand, The Fountainhead is my over and over again. I can read it once a year.
I'm in the first book group of my entire life. I mean, here I am, a million years old, in my first book group. And we're doing Middlemarch. We're doing George Eliot's Middlemarch, which is a book I love so much. And I've read it, I probably read it 6 or 7 times. And every time I read it, it's a different book. So that would be one right up there.
Is there a new contemporary book from a new author or something more recent that you would recommend?
There are too many. And too many of them are my friends. So I don't want to leave anyone out.
We can't go there. All right, let me get to another a question. With Simon's name a play on publishing giants? Obviously, Simon Putnam. That's what I thought. Originally, I thought, oh, yeah, well, here, she's being very plain.
Oh, my God.
About it.
Never thought about it.
Really?
Yeah,
come
really.
On.
No, seriously, it never crossed my mind. I mean, that, you know, stuff like that always happens, and it's wonderful. I mean, it happens with students, too, where they'll say, like, did you mean to mention stars in the first line of the story and the last line? And they'll go, huh? So no, I had no, and that was not intentional. I'm fabulously interested that someone picked that up.
Oh, I think everybody who reads it, that was my first thought too. Like, oh, Putnam and then Simon and Schuster. Okay, I get that. What do you know? We had talked about a little bit about Uncle Matty, and that's a character I want to explore a little bit. Simon's uncle who gets him the job at the publishing house. He's just not a great, like, not somebody you want. I just didn't like him at all. There was nothing I liked about him except the fact that he helped get him the job. What was the purpose of sort of making him such a deplorable character, even in the beginning?
Well, there were guys like that. I mean, there was a whole world of guys like that. And in fact, when I was thinking about the book and reading for the book, I was reading a lot of their, and some of them were good guys and some of them weren't. So I was reading like Norman Podhoretz and Alfred Kazin and Lionel Trilling. As I said, some of them were good, but I wanted their voices in my head. And also those guys were like feuding with each other all the time and battling about reputation and trashing each other. So he would have been part of a certain literary culture that was prevalent in power at that time.
It was interesting to me, too, because he was one who did not want to acknowledge his background, his Jewishness, that he was pretty much adamantly against it. Was that purposeful as well to sort of make him that, you know, that's not my world?
Lucky for him, he was named Madison Putnam. I mean, who would know if you would deny it? No, certainly. I mean, and those guys had a kind of tortured relation to Jewishness, to their own Jewishness. So again, I was working to a certain extent from life. I mean, thinking about those guys and who they were and what their ambitions were and what world they wanted to live in and create them for themselves and where they come from in the relation to this self-created identity and their true identity. So that was kind of working all the way through it.
How much research did you have to do about the Rosenbergs and, you know, the whole situation? Because you have some very specific evidence in the book that is kind of, I don't want to give it away, but it's kind of woven throughout the story. Did you have to do a whole deep dive, a lot of research on them? Were you able to talk to your mom over the years about them so you had some institutional knowledge?
Well, there are quite a few books about the Rosenbergs out there, and their sons have written several books. So that was out there. But also, and the thing is, I'm still finding out things that I wish I'd known at the time that I didn't know when I was writing the book. I mean, for example, as you kind of mentioned, I don't think it's entirely a spoiler, because it's true. The chief piece of evidence that the government had against the Rosenbergs was this Jell-O box. It was a cardboard box of Jell-O that had been cut into a kind of zigzag shape. And the two spies recognize each other when the two halves of the Jell-O box fit together. And one of them said, I am come from the Rosenbergs. And the two. Now, I mean, when you think about it for 2 seconds, it is the most absurd, ridiculous thing. The two, this one would cut up a Jell-O box, really? And then they would put them together. Well, what I just learned just a couple of weeks ago was that, of course, the government, the FBI, didn't have the original Jell-O box. So they just cut up a Jell-O box and brought it to the trial and said, this is what it must have been like. And then I started thinking, well, look, either it happened or it didn't happen. That is the Jell-O box. And if it didn't happen, someone made it up. So part of what happens in the last half of the book was kind of prompted by that question.
Probably one of the funniest parts to me was the line where Simon's mom says, I wish she would have kept kosher.
The cow's hoofs, right, boil down to make jelly.
Exactly. I mean, that just, it literally makes you laugh out loud. When I read that, I was just like, well, there it is. And, you know, as we mentioned in the introduction, you know, it's either a seriously funny book or a funny, serious book. How do you see it?
Well, both. I mean, I have to say that publishing the book has been an unusually kind of great experience for me, because one of the things that I was really worried about was whether people would get the idea of that there a comic novel that has in the background the execution of the Rosenbergs, which was a tragedy, really. So that balancing act, first, I didn't know if I could get away with it. And secondly, I didn't know if I did think I got away with it, if anyone else would understand what I did or what I was trying to do. Because it is serious. I mean, it's a serious novel about serious things. It just happens to be funny all the way through. So it's been very, very gratifying to me that reviewers and friends and just people seem to get what it is and get what I was doing. So it's kind of been, in many ways, better than I imagined it would be, which it rarely happens.
Here's a question that popped up. How much, if at all, do you think the Rosenbergs' Jewishness played in to their conviction?
Huge. I mean, there was, at the time, people knew that it was that anti-Semitism. I mean, of course, the judge who sentenced them, Judge Kaufman, was Jewish. And of course, the evil Roy Cohn, who was the prosecutor, was Jewish. So it wasn't as if these were two Jews who were being persecuted by the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant establishment. But it did play into the popular anti-Semitism of the 50s and the association of Jews with communists and subversives and so forth. That was certainly part of it.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is author Francine Prose, whose new novel is The Vixen. She's joined in conversation by Holly Furfer. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Yeah, I mean, and if you think about it, very much like Uncle Matty, who sort of ignored his past, Roy Cohen, again, did not embrace his Jewishness for the most part, especially I know a lot in the Jewish community were aghast that he would be on a witch hunt against the Rosenbergs and others for McCarthy. How much do you think about, you know, we talk about truth, we talk about what we read, we talk about fact and fiction. How important is it to for something like that that happened in the 1950s? How relevant is it today? Here we are in 2021, especially since, you know, we've had, you know, fake news and this whole resurgence of the idea of maybe what you're reading is not true.
Well, I'm kind of old fashioned that way. I mean, I think either something happened or it didn't. And I'm writing about things that happened. I mean, I should say that since in the years since then, certain things about the Rosenbergs, I mean, it seems fairly clear now that Julius Rosenberg was a communist. And we know they were communists, but he was recruiting other people to spy for the Russians. Ethel seems to have been really innocent. I mean, she typed up something. But the heart of the case, which is that Ethel's brother passed along some instructions for making a detonator for the atom bomb. I mean, if you look at this diagram, it's like something you get from IKEA for putting furniture together, only worse. You could not build an atom bomb from this. You could not build anything. So much of that case was specious, was completely fake news, was designed to just crank up the anti-communism, anti-Semitism, nationalism of the time.
Do you see a lot of that today? I mean, look at what, you know, you can go on Facebook, you can go on Twitter, you go on all the social media and all of these, there's right-wing, left-wing publications, newspapers online, the journal, because it's called a journal, somebody will quote an article from a journal. Have we really moved that far forward from 1950s? Have we reverted back to that time?
Well, that's why it was weirdly easy to finally write it, because I felt that some of it was imagining my way back 50 years, 70 years. And some of it was reportage. I mean, what it felt like to live at the present moment where there was so much distrust of what we were being told, is so much distrust of what we were being told. And then you just go back to that time where that was very much the tenor of the moment.
And here's a question, and it sort of brings up, it ties that together. Are any thoughts on the resurgence of the Rosenbergs and their execution? We've seen books, including yours, their granddaughter has a documentary. We're hearing more stories come out now. Is it a coincidence that we're hearing about this in 2021?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's interesting because I do, as I said, I do think there's so many correspondences between that time and this. But yeah, there's a brilliant documentary that Ivy Meeropol, who's the granddaughter of the Rosenbergs, made about the case. And another one she made about Roy Cohen. And a biography of Ethel Rosenberg has just come out. So for whatever reason, and I think you're right, I mean, I think it has to do with the way we're living now, there has been a resurgence of interest in that case.
Wait, as a professor, do you feel an obligation to also, you know, talk to your students while studying literature? While these are students who are pretty much studying history through literature and also, you know, probably very much avid readers, how to be critical thinkers and how to understand and put this kind of stuff in context.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it's always interesting to me because my students who are super smart and super aware and articulate, and I mean, I adore them, but there are these huge gaps in their education. I mean, for example, they seem to know nothing about anything that happened in the 70s, 80s, and the 90s. I mean, nothing. So, I mean, for example, none of them I taught, unfortunately, on Zoom last fall. And we were talking about I was teaching a story by Roberto Bolaños, which had to do with the aftermath of the dictatorship in Chile. And we were talking about the American involvement in the various South American dictatorships. And the name Henry Kissinger came up, and not one of them had ever heard of Henry Kissinger. They had no idea. And these were smart, smart kids. Wow. So there are a lot of things. I mean, I taught another story that took place in Guatemala during the 80s, and there was a kind of reference to bloodshed and so forth. And they thought that it was about the conquistadors because they had no idea about the mass slaughters that were going on in Guatemala at the civil wars and so forth. So I do feel it's part of my job to fill them in and on areas of history that for some reason have just dropped out of the curriculum. They don't know very much about Vietnam either. And of course, when I grew up, that was our reality.
Wow. It's a little frightening. It's somewhat not surprising. Do you feel, I mean, like social media, well, how do you feel about social media, especially now when, you know, talking about fake news, fact versus fiction, and the generations that are growing up with social media as their guide versus, you know, encyclopedias and, you know, newspapers, legitimate newspapers and history books, legitimate history books?
Well, I think it's made the job of parents that much more difficult because they're always, I mean, I know I have four grandchildren, so I know that my kids are always having to kind of run a counter TikTok operation in their house. Or, I mean, even the way in which my granddaughters, I mean, my beloved daughter-in-law was very clear about the way in which she thought that Disney was brainwashing her daughters, my granddaughters, into wanting to be princesses and so forth. So she felt that part of her job as their mom was to undo the princess mythology that they were getting all the time. So I think it means that parents have to be warier to see what their kids are learning and where they're learning it from. So on the other hand, I have to say, I love Instagram. I just love Instagram. I mean, I really got into it during the lockdown because I wasn't looking at art. I mean, I couldn't go and look at art. And for one reason or another, I know a lot of photographers who also couldn't show and so forth. So they were just posting their stuff on Instagram all the time. So it was my way of seeing these images that were really interesting to me when I couldn't go to a gallery and I couldn't go to, and I've stayed kind of hooked on it. You know, I'm Instagramming my garden all the time, like a real old person, but that's what I do.
Hey, look, we do our food. There's many pictures of my dog on there. I completely understand. Does that though, you know, hearing these stories and knowing that and the story that you told about Henry Kissinger and your daughter-in-law story, do you feel that you have sort of an obligation as a writer to start writing more stories like this one that's eye-opening about the Rosenbergs, eye-opening about McCarthyism, communism, the CIA, the government, the 50s?
No, I really
no.
I don't feel that it's sort of my obligation to do anything. I mean, I'm just trying to write. Really, I'm just trying to write a story that holds together, that seems true to me, even though it's a story that, you know, where the characters are as complicated as we know human beings are, and where they get themselves into situations that we could imagine human beings would get themselves in. And then if something else comes out of it, something about history or something about the truth or something about politics, that's just gravy for me. I mean, the rest is really what I'm trying to do, write a novel.
So are you working on something new? Because there's a question that says, please tell us what you're working on next. What can we look forward to?
Well, I just finished, or I'm just finishing. I was at, during lockdown, a friend of mine at Bard is editing a series of ancient lives. So he asked me about biographies, short biographies of figures from classical times. So he asked me if I would write a biography of Cleopatra. So, and it's like 150 pages long. And it turns out, honestly, people know about five or six things about that are verifiably true about Cleopatra. And the rest comes from Shakespeare and Plutarch and so on. So I've just finished it. And it was huge fun. I mean, to be basically stuck in my house and reading about things that had happened 2,000 years ago was just bliss.
How do you verify that? I mean, talk about doing research and knowing what's true, what's not, what's myth, what's storytelling, very much like the Rosenbergs, right? There's a million stories that came out and it's, oh, my mother's neighbor's sister used to be her friend or this. Or there's so many stories that come out. So how do you verify and able to tell a story like that when there's really not a whole lot of written proof?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one is that I found myself writing about the people who wrote about her. So the way in which she was written. And also it was kind of interesting to track the way women were written about for 2000 years or portrayed in films. I mean, you know, the one of the fun things was watching the original like, for example, Theda Bara and Claudette Colbert, their versions of Cleopatra. I mean, Theda Bara is gone, but Claudette, and those were pre-code Hollywood. And they were so dirty. It was unbelievable. I mean, you cannot believe how the way Cleopatra was dressed. And then I watched all 4.5 hours of Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And really the hardest part of the job was having to watch it twice, because I had to write, the first time I was just watching, and then I had to write down quotes from it. So that was, you know, tedious at best.
How long does it take you to do something like that? I mean, we're talking weeks? Are we talking months?
No, I took about it on. I was working on and off for about a year, and it was mostly what I was doing during the pandemic.
Interesting. And somebody asked, "What everyone's looking for ways to decompress nowadays, especially since it looks like we may be going into another tough period with COVID. So, what do you do to relax besides Instagram? And obviously, you garden. But as we're going into the winter, what do you do? What kind of things help you sort of center yourself so that you can write that next great novel?"
Well, as you said, gardening is a huge help. I mean, I've just been gardening like crazy all summer. And the truth, are we telling? I mean, we talked about this before. I watch a lot of really terrible TV. I just watch a lot of terrible TV. And it's, I mean, I hate that word therapeutic, but it's, I mean, I just feel, it's so hard. And I think so many people, myself included, have been having a hard time. And it's such a crazy moment that we're living in so many ways. And I know it's crazy for kids. It's certainly crazy for my grandchildren. So I think that anything that just amuses you and makes you happier and makes you feel like you, you know, in the simplest level, that makes it easier to get through the day, I'm all for it.
Do you find yourself, I mean, sometimes I find myself watching the news, watching television. We're seeing what's going on in Afghanistan. We're seeing what's going on with COVID. And you hear these stories that people are telling, these very personal stories. Does anything like that inspire you as a writer to think, this is great. This is great storytelling. I want to focus on this, or I want to learn more about this so I can write about this. Or do you sort of just say, something hits you one day? How do you go about that creative process of finding that next novel?
Well, things just lodge in your brain. And you can't get rid of them. I mean, someone will tell you a story, or I'll overhear something, or I'll see something. I mean, you know, one of the things about lockdown that made it harder to write fiction was that I realized how dependent I am on things I overhear or eavesdrop, or someone tells me at a party or something, or, you know, when I was more in the city, things I would see on the subway. So having to manufacture your own things like that, it made it quite a bit more difficult. But my previous novel before, the last novel before this one, Mr. Monkey, I took my granddaughter, who was 6, to this kind of awful off-Broadway play, because I've been taking her Broadway. And, you know, once I realized the tickets were like $300, I went, okay, that's it. You know, we're not, we're only going to things that are like $15.
We're going to regional theater.
And we went to this terrible, sad play in the, you know, super low budget, and everybody's costumes were falling apart and the spotlight couldn't find any of the characters. So there'd be light over here and blah, blah. And my granddaughter, as a friend of mine said, she has beautiful manners, said to me in what she thought was a noisy moment in the play, she said, "Are you interested in this?" And it turned out to be a quiet moment in the play, and the entire theater heard it. So I said, "Yeah." And then I had to write the entire book to prove that I was interested in it. So that's, you know, many, many of these things have just started with little chance occurrences like that. And then a whole book would come out of them.
The Glorious Ones made into a musical in 2007. What was that experience like, having something made into a musical?
I loved it. I mean, I was sort of wary because I used to love musicals when I was a kid, and now I find them sort of weird. I mean, the moment when people burst into songs.
Yeah, right.
So I was wary of it. And then the woman who wrote the couple who wrote the music and the lyrics invited me to her apartment in the city to listen to the songs. And they were so beautiful. that I was just a big fan. So I really loved it. And all the time I was kind of pretending that it wasn't a musical, but it was musical. And it was great. It was really great.
Does it make you want to write purposefully a musical, maybe?
No. Okay. Although my son is one of my sons is a musician. So I've written stuff, a few lyrics for him every so often. So a little bit, yeah. But
wow, amazing. Well, you never know. I'm going to hold out for Esther and Julian Rosenstein, the musical, the comedy musical.
Yeah, Springtime for Hitler.
Oh my gosh, Francine, it was so wonderful to talk to you. I appreciate all of your time. The book, The Vixen. Oh, before we go, I have to ask you about this cover. This cover is fantastic.
Isn't it great? I found it, of course, those are the Rosenbergs kissing.
Yes, right here.
I found the image for them. And then they did this design, which is gorgeous. And also because television is such a big factor in the thing. And it sort of looks like a test pattern. I mean, it has that color test pattern thing to it.
It tells you so much. And I just have to tell you two stories. So I was out of town last week and I took it with me and I was reading it on the plane and people were giving me the side eye, like I was reading some kind of trashy sort of Harlequin novel. And at one point I was like, should I take the cover off? But I ended up having to tell people it's a fiction book. It's great. It's really not. That's the Rosenbergs, the ones that were executed, like to try and... So it actually, to me, sort of spoke to the entire story that you told, the seriousness, ridiculously funny aspects of the whole story. But thank you so much. It's just a wonderful book. And I really look forward. Thank you so much, Francine Pose. The Vixen is so wonderful. And thank you all for joining us. Absolutely appreciate all of you. Stay happy, stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned. We'll see you very soon.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author Francine Prose, whose new novel is The Vixen. She was joined in conversation by Holly Furfer. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.